The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It looks like martial law on the streets of Brussels, Belgium. A lockdown of Brussels while authorities try to disrupt the communities of Muslim citizens in their midst, believed to constitute a network of radicalization in Europe. Federal officials at first described what they said was a serious and imminent terror threat. Then the government responded to questions about widespread raids all around the city.
The Federal Prosecution's Office and the Brussels investigating judge specialized in terrorist cases ordered a total of 19 house searches in the Brussels region.
Eric van der Sipt is a spokesman from Belgium's prosecutor's office. 16 suspects were arrested in all those raids. But Salah Abdeslam, one of the terrorists behind the Paris attacks, whose picture has been flashed across the world, was not among them. Andy Townend is a photographer and writer in Brussels. He lives in the neighborhood of Molenbeek, a predominantly Muslim community in Brussels, one that has come to be described as a breeding ground for jihadists. Townend says it will be some time before Molenbeek is able to live all this down.
Look, I think at the moment it has a bad reputation, which is very unfortunate. It is quite a distinct suburb of Brussels, but unfortunately at the moment a very small minority of people have given it a very bad name, which is very sad.
Give me a sense of the demographics of the place.
It is largely an African and Islamic community. So I'm living in Molenbeek myself at the moment, and I'm a bit of an ethnic minority. But I've never felt scared on the streets. It is quite different. It has a very distinctive community feel. You know, there are some great, very colorful markets there. But it is quite distinct from the remainder of Brussels. And, you know, it is slightly set apart, I guess.
How much has this alert and this sense of vigilance that the government has encouraged and is actively involved in raids around the city, how much have they ratcheted up this tension and suspicion of neighbor to neighbor?
Well, it's been very strange. I mean, we're now into the third day of what's been called the Brussels lockdown, where there are, you know, hundreds of soldiers on the streets. There are raids taking place. But I'm living in Molenbeek, and although we've seen a lot of police activity, we've had helicopters overhead and all the rest of it, the sense on the street is still quite friendly. You know, I mean, I, as I say, I don't feel intimidated walking around. And I spoke to a lady from the local community just on Saturday night, and she was expressing her sadness, really, that the area had got a reputation and was being sort of badged as some kind of center of terrorism, when in fact the problems are being caused by just, you know, a relatively small number of people.
Are there checkpoints around the city?
Well, there aren't any formal checkpoints, but I know yesterday, for example, during the evening, there was some activity in the Grand Place, which is the very heart of Brussels, and I believe the police had kind of secured some areas because there was some kind of operation underway, and they were very anxious, in fact, to make sure that social media didn't report on what was going on, although I don't think they succeeded in that. So there are no formal checkpoints, but there are armoured vehicles and soldiers everywhere. I was in the centre of town on Saturday, and I know 8 or 10 armored vehicles all in a convoy patrolling around. So there's a huge show of force on the ground, which is quite remarkable, even by Brussels standards.
And when the police say that their raids have resulted in foiling of plots that were in sort of in process, any sense of what they're talking about?
It's very difficult to say, but I mean, the main impact of the lockdown has been the total shutdown of the underground metro services. Now, obviously, I can't speak for them, but buses and trams on the surface have continued, albeit there have been a lot of interruptions. Trains have continued. There are soldiers all over the place, but the metro has been completely sealed down. So one can only assume that perhaps they had some sense of something happening on the underground metro system, but I really don't know.
But as far as a duplicate of what went on in Paris, there's no specific outlining of, you know, commandos with suicide vests, that sort of thing.
No, nobody's been talking about that kind of thing. No, I mean, the Prime Minister was on the television just through the weekend, very pointedly saying that they had very firm, specific evidence of specific threats, but it's very difficult to say what. I mean, all I can say is, as an observer and a photographer of what's been happening, is there's been a massive military presence at all of the major public areas in Brussels. And in fact, this weekend should have been an incredibly busy weekend, you know, in the weeks running up to Christmas. And on Saturday, the place was a ghost town. Yesterday, there were more people in the city, but nowhere near as many as usual.
How long can they keep this going? I mean, in a sense, if you relax it and something happens, then you've really made a mistake.
Well, it's a real tough call. I mean, I was in London on the 7th of July 2005 when the terrorists did actually strike. And I was one of many people who the very next day was back on the underground going to work and carrying on life as normal. So to shut down a city's transportation system and have troops on the streets for 3 days is already quite remarkable. And many people are sort of asking the question you're asking. I mean, it's very difficult. They're a tough call. I mean, what do they do? If they hadn't shut the city down this weekend and something happened, they'd be blamed. If they paralyze parts of the public transport system, they're also blamed. It's a tough call.
Andy Townend is a photographer and writer speaking to us from Brussels. Thanks so much, Andy.
Thank you.
A war in Europe? That's how Europeans see the aftermath of the attacks in Paris more than a week later. The whole question of how to approach ISIS after Paris has created a problem for candidate Hillary Clinton. As Secretary of State, she was able to speak out on policy issues while hammering out aggressive deals with the White House in the background. That's how the Libyan policy came about. But as a candidate, she's having a difficult time knowing how to respond to the attacks without criticizing a popular Democrat by the name of Barack Obama. Kim Gottes is BBC correspondent and author of The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power.
It's easy in the aftermath of the Paris attacks to overestimate what impact this is going to have on the presidential race and how long that impact will last. But it's also possible to underestimate it. And that's something that Hillary Clinton is going to have to keep an eye on. Immediately after the debate in Des Moines, Clinton had another event in Iowa where she already did some course correction about the need for America to lead the fight. Whereas in the debate, she had said this is not an American fight.
We can bring people together, but it cannot be an American fight.
And she got lambasted by Republicans for saying that. By the beginning of the week, her team had already decided she was going to give a national security speech to lay out her vision about American foreign policy, but to a specialized audience at the Council on Foreign Relations. And there she was much more assertive, much more forceful, much more muscular. And she did very clearly make a difference between where she stands and where the president stands.
Our goal is not to deter or contain ISIS, but to defeat and destroy ISIS. It will require sustained commitment in every pillar of American power.
But at the same time, she still refused to take the bait when someone said, you know, are you setting yourself apart from the president?
Ironically, those precise points might possibly are quite likely to be made by Francois Hollande in Washington when he meets with the president. He's going to demand more cooperation, more involvement of the United States, possibly even boots on the ground, certainly more airstrikes. Is the president likely to lead in this situation, or what do you think?
It's still a little bit unclear. When President Obama gave a press conference at the G20 summit in Turkey, he was asked repeatedly about his strategy, whether he had been wrong, whether he had underestimated the so-called Islamic State. And he was very much on the defensive. He didn't choose to say, well, this has been our strategy up till now, but clearly the Paris attacks signal a turning point in that group's strategy, so we may have to rethink. There was none of that. There was just, this has been the strategy. Nothing that's been suggested will lead to any different results. And he very much stuck to his guns.
Although the media questions, some of them were completely outrageous. I mean, they kept asking him, take him out, blow him away, which made him a little impatient.
There has been a lot of criticism from former administration officials as well, who blame the president. And the president is right in saying that it's hard to predict how things would have unfolded differently had he taken more assertive action early on. But, you know, President François Hollande, after the Charlie Hebdo attack in January, made a very interesting comment in the aftermath. He said, if we had struck Syria, as we had planned to do in 2013, in the aftermath of the chemical gas attack there, we wouldn't be here today. And so President Hollande is clearly making a connection between the inaction of the West and how things have unfolded in the Middle East, particularly in Syria, as the so-called Islamic State is allowed to gain territory and use that territory as a staging ground for attacks in the West.
short of a gigantic invasion of Syria, what would be a comprehensive strategy to roll up ISIS?
It's very difficult to fully contain, or as Hillary Clinton and other and Republican candidates are saying, to destroy an organization like this. I mean, we're talking about facts in the sense that 14 years after the September 11th attack, Al-Qaeda is still there. It hasn't been destroyed. Unfortunately, in many cases like this, the slogans, the calls to action sound good, but the reality is that this is a long-term challenge. And a lot of observers and people in the region will tell you, if you want to defeat or if you want to start containing ISIS, you need to deprive them of their rallying cry, which is Sunnis in the Arab world are under attack. And how do you do that? By bringing in the Sunnis in Iraq into the process, by giving them a reason to fight against the so-called Islamic State, and by bringing Sunnis in Syria on board as well. And that's the challenge. It's trying to do those two things in parallel, the military action against the so-called Islamic State and the political dimension of this puzzle that has been ignored for almost 2 years and has also led to the terrible tragedy of the refugee crisis.
If they get some sort of recognition of territory as a nation out of this, can they take that to the bank? Or
no one that I have spoken to in the US or in Europe or in the Arab world in particular, no one is ready to admit or to give that territorial recognition to this organization. This organization has imposed, as we say, facts on the ground. They are there. They are ruling over these towns. But no one that I have spoken to in the Arab world particularly is ready to admit or to grant them territorial recognition as an actual state. You know, there have been articles written in the US about how we should just live with the Islamic State.
Well, Josh Earnest has said at the news, at some of the briefings, degrade their capability in their own state, suggesting that they have some sort of territory.
It is not something that I have heard many people, if any, in the Arab world say that this is something that they can live with.
Kim Gaddas is a correspondent for the BBC. She's the author of The Secretary, A Journey with Hillary Clinton from Beirut to the Heart of American Power.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on travel tips, Tabata training, toy making, and more. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Can world leaders clarify their stance on what to do about ISIS, or will the Syrian civil war continue to be a place to take potshots from the air on places like Raqqa in Syria, where ISIS claims to have its capital city? French President François Hollande arrives in Washington tomorrow for what is shaping up to be a crucial meeting with President Obama that might reveal some clues. Laura Haim is White House correspondent for Canal Plus, a French television channel. She says Hollande believes President Obama has to do something dramatic and now in the fight against ISIS.
He really wants something to change. I think he feels that there's something which is not working. And he wants to make sure that together, the most important countries in the world are going to be united, build up a coalition, and try to do something new about ISIS in Syria, in Iraq, and all over the world.
Is he going to publicly take a stand for a coalition invasion of Syria?
I don't think so, but it has to be seen. I don't like to speak about something which is so fluctuant at this moment. That definitely, according to the people I spoke with, want to have more resources to fight ISIS. What does it mean? It means more strikes, precise strikes against terrorists in Syria and maybe in Iraq and all over again, dismantle the cells, a full cooperation with the intelligence agencies all over the world. Now, the question, and that's a legitimate question that people all over the world in the Western world have at this moment, is it enough? Can you win a war with no ground troops on the soil? And this is a very sensitive issue for the French because we are not structured in the way the American army is. But you have a lot of people now who are trying to say we have to do something to prevent other attacks. Europe, France, Italy, Germany, Belgium, they are the targets. And it's quite interesting to see the level in the United States of fear. Oh my God, it could happen. We don't know when, but it's going to happen. I think, and I hope, I don't like to say that, but I'm going to say that anyway. Europe is the prime target. The people who attacked France, they were coming from Syria, but they were French. The cells in Europe are with people who are born in Europe, who have been raised in Europe, who are going for a few months in Syria, but they come back to their own countries to do something against their homeland. At this moment, Europe is at war. France is at war. The French Prime Minister said it 2 days ago. The French President is repeating it. This is a war in Europe. And in this element in mind, the French President is coming to the United States to see how the United States want to help France at war.
Would Hollande ask the United States to help pay for the resources to actually deal with this radicalization that's taking place? I mean, it's not like the invasion is you're waiting for it from ISIS. It's already there. The people who will attack in France and Belgium and in these other countries in Europe are already on the ground.
Yes, and nobody knows how to stop that because it's going to take a generation, even two generations. It's going to, it's fascinating in a journalistic way, and I had to say that, but it's really interesting to see how those people are fully radicalized. It's the same story over and over again, and it's not a problem which is going to be taken care of in 2 months. When you have been radicalized, you're radicalized when you're 12 or 13 years old or 14 years old. Why? Because there's no job where you live. You feel completely rejected because you have an Arabic name. And you're tempted by drugs. So maybe one day you're arrested, you go to prison, and then you meet someone and he's telling you that through religion, there's a better life. And then you go to a mosque. You meet someone in a mosque who is completely radicalized, who is sent by ISIS or by other people to choose young people, and the radicalization begins, and then with the internet, they get in touch with you, and you feel that you have a family which understands you, and they manage your mind to make sure that you're leaving for Syria. And then in Syria, you have the training camps, and then they send you back. So it's going to take a lot of thinkings from François Hollande to fight that and have a solution.
What if President Obama says, well, this is your problem, the radicalization. We'll help with the airstrikes, but there's not much we can do about the radicalization. You've let that happen to yourself.
I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know what's going to happen if when there's an attack in the United States, because according to our sources, it's difficult for them to come here. But with, again, the internet, they have cells. They have cells who want to strike the United States or the symbol of the United States. So I don't know what the president is going to decide. You know, when you speak to the French people and when you go to France and when you have dinner with the French people and you know how the dinners in France are passionate, we have political discussion from 8 o'clock in the evening to 1 o'clock in the morning. In the discussion, each time I'm going there in the past year, I always had to answer to this question. Why does Obama didn't put ground troops in Syria? Now it's too late. And people in France loved President Obama. I mean, in 2008 and even in 2012, 80% of the French wanted Obama as the president, and he was extremely popular. Now, in the past 3 years, people are, what's happening with Obama? Why he didn't go to Syria? Does he understand how it's bad? And especially the intellectual people of France are really now criticizing the president for his lack of helping Hollande 3 years ago when Hollande wanted to go to Syria.
Laura Haim is White House correspondent for Canal Plus, a French cable television channel. Laura, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
What will Iran look like 10 years from now? A young girl captured in a cover shot in Time magazine this month seems to stare longingly into a future where she might live in a more secular, open Iran that's all about rich culture and commerce, not religion and nukes. Filmmaker Mazyar Bahari believes that change will come to Iran, but it will take some time.
As the recent tragedies in other countries in the neighborhood, in Libya, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, have shown, sudden changes, overnight changes are not good for countries. The only way that you can have sustainable change in countries is through gradual change, sometimes through excruciatingly slow changes. And it's just mind-boggling for me that people who supported the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, they are against this nuclear deal with Iran, and they are advocating attacking Iran. And they're just giving the airtime again to advocate another war with another Muslim Middle Eastern country.
Mazyar Bahari is a journalist who spent 118 days in an Iranian prison covering Iran's 2009 elections, an experience that got him a part in Jon Stewart's satirical movie about press censorship, Rosewater. He says hardline Iranian authorities have targeted journalists since the passing of the Iran nuclear deal, a deal which once again has exposed just how fearful the Iranian clergy seems to be of secularization of any kind. Mazyar Bahari founded the Journalism Is Not a Crime campaign, an organization that fights against the unfair targeting and arrests of journalists in Iran.
Well, when I came out of prison, I realized what an amazing campaign my employer at that time, Newsweek magazine, and my friends all around the world had for me. And I promised myself to do the same thing for my colleagues, especially the colleagues inside Iran who are unknown to people around the world, whose names are very difficult to pronounce. At least people can pronounce my name somehow. But I didn't know that it was going to be such a difficult task, because when I was arrested in 2009, it was just the beginning of Iranian government's crackdown on journalists. Since then, at least 300 journalists have been imprisoned. Most of them have been released, but it's a revolving door. They arrest some people, they release some people. And recently, just last week, five journalists were arrested, and on different charges. Even the president of Iran has objected to the arrest of these journalists.
What were the circumstances of your arrest?
They basically wanted to teach a lesson to a large group of journalists and filmmakers. And because I was a documentary filmmaker and journalist, they arrested me in order to show other journalists and filmmakers in the country what they can do. And that is very typical of the Iranian government, that they basically want to make an example of a person or a group of people. For example, with the arrest of these five journalists last week, the reason that the Revolutionary Guards arrested them was that they, as they said that they wanted to stop the infiltration of the American culture in the country. They said that the Americans, they want to change our way of life and through after the a nuclear deal. And these journalists, specifically these five journalists, they were agents, the infiltrators, American infiltrators inside our country. So through the arrest of these five people, they wanted to teach a lesson to a large group of people that if you approve the deal, if you talk about the great examples of the American culture, American films, American music, then this can happen to you as well. So we have to see what is going to happen to these five journalists, these five colleagues of mine.
Now, I'm looking at some of the language here, and it's all in English, not Farsi. It seems as though these individuals, or one of them, was arrested on the charge of trying to prettify the image of America?
Exactly.
Say the whole crime you've been accused of in Farsi.
Zibasazi chehre Amerika, prettifying the image of the United States.
I mean, that almost sounds like something that would end up on The Daily Show.
Basically, these governments, like the Iranian government, like the Egyptian government, Russian government, they provide material for the comedians, unwantedly, of course. They take themselves so seriously. And through taking themselves so seriously, they just look ridiculous.
Let's hear how Rosewater, the movie, treats some of these circumstances here.
I am a journalist. That's it. Nothing more.
Just advised.
Yes.
As a spy, I'm just trying to figure out why your country is so terrifying.
So can you tell me why just journalists meet up with this American spy on the Eva Lundquist?
He's not a spy.
He's not a spy?
No, it's a show.
It's a show?
A comedy show. It's stupid.
It's very stupid, yes.
As you were doing this film, it's funny, but does it feel funny to you?
It is funny with hindsight, but I have to say that many of the ridiculous things that happened to me in prison, they didn't end up in the book or the film because the editors of the book and John Stewart, the director of the film, they thought that it was too ridiculous to include them in the book or the film.
Would you say that Rosewater, the film, is in a sense John Stewart's statement of appreciation to the Iranian government for giving him so much material all these years?
It is that, definitely. I think he somehow appreciates all these dictatorships for providing material to him and other journalists, of course. It was also, maybe we can say, a love letter to many journalists around the world that John thinks that they are doing their jobs under very difficult circumstances, while many journalists in free countries, like in the United States, are not doing their jobs, even though they have all the freedom to that affords them to be able to do their jobs.
Maziar Bahari is a journalist and documentary filmmaker. He's founder of the Journalism is Not a Crime campaign.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Novelist Patricia Highsmith once said that taking up writing was not really a choice for her.
Ever since I was 16 or 17, I get what is sometimes called creepy ideas.
Here she is explaining decades ago about how those creepy ideas became a body of work known the world over. Traditional mysteries with very untraditional views of morality and men.
I often victimize a man in my story. They're influenced by the circumstances that hit them, and then they succumb to temptation or something and do something they shouldn't.
Patricia Highsmith's books have been drawing men and women into her dark, creepy world since she first gained success with the novel Strangers on a Train. Highsmith, who died in 1995, has been a favorite of Hollywood directors who steer toward the psychological thriller. Todd Haynes loves the dark, sometimes creepy places where gender and sexuality become blended and collide with so-called proper conduct. Haynes' newest film, Carol, is based on Highsmith's The Price of Salt. A woman named Carol falls in love with a young sales girl named Therese. A meeting at a shop, then a meal, then an invitation.
What do you do on Sundays?
Nothing in particular. What do you do?
Oh, nothing lately. Maybe you'd like to come visit me sometime. You're welcome to. At least there's some pretty country around where I live. Would you like to come visit me this Sunday?
Yes.
Kate Blanchett plays Carol and Rooney Mara stars as Therese. Todd Haynes says his two lead actresses play characters standing at the edge of a moral chasm that was ripped open in the 20th century and continues to widen today.
What you encounter in Carol is these two extremely different and interesting characters at very different places in their lives, very different stations in the world, occupying different kinds of power over the other. And Carol has a complicated backstory, and she has had a relationship with a woman that we know about, played by Sarah Paulson, her friend Abby. The friendship has survived this relationship, this love affair. It's had a clear impact on this marriage of hers that's falling apart. But for Therese, played by Rooney Mara, I think she really is piecing together the vernacular of her feelings. And what the vicissitudes, sorry for that Freudian term, but what the implications of this desire really does mean for her. And I think that part of it is a process of of, you know, negation. Like she sees this butch femme couple at one point in the movie in a record store, and there's a moment of aversion. You know, so it's a process of elimination in some ways as to who she really is.
Do you think the oppression of women and the forbiddenness of being gay conflict, make it harder to tell a love story in this particular
No. Film? In fact, quite the reverse. I think what love stories always require first is an obstacle that keeps the lovers apart. And you have to believe that there's some reality for that, some viability in that, you know, and that gets maybe harder to imagine as we move forward in a progressive society, why two people can't be together. But also the fact that there isn't a language for it or a representation for it for these women means that it's the silences in the movie, the glances in the movie, the music, the cinematography, all of the other elements of what makes a movie great have a more important role to play in telling the story, because it's not just about words anymore. So in that way, I think it's all fueled by those interesting omissions.
How is this movie that is about choices that these women have to make about who they are and what they are as they enter this relationship that's so important to them, how do their choices reflect choices you had to make in your own creative life, in your own personal life? How is it a narrative about the choices we all make and what we look at and say, it's not me, but this is me, but, you know, that sort of thing?
That's interesting. I think about something Phyllis Nage, the screenwriter, has said and really admired about The Price of Salt and what she tried to preserve in her adaptation of the script, and I think it's in the film, is a sense of the unapologetic, a sense of the not like really searching for the Freudian sort of explanation for or the guilt that might be associated with certain realizations of who you are. But more, and this I think again speaks to something very universal, regardless of the kind of sexual object we're talking about in life, whether it is of the same sex or a different sex or whatever. It's more that it's about an affirmation of you as a self, period, solely, so that when they return their feelings to you, that's all you needed to know. And if they don't, that's all you needed to know. You know, it's a kind of battle of the self. And I guess in some ways as a filmmaker, I've sort of forged ahead without really necessarily expecting to land in any particular one place, without a particular goal. I'm going to become a feature filmmaker who puts out narrative features each year. I never really began with that expectation about my work. There seemed to be a more diverse, challenging or challengeable audience when I began my work in the early 90s, you know, still coming out of experimental film and experimental theater. I mean, I always think of something Fran Lebowitz said, that the AIDS era, we didn't just lose artists, but we lost an audience. We lost audiences that demanded complexity from the artist, you know.
To reference some Hollywood meringue, you're kind of riding the Kate Blanchett rocket right about now. And it's possible that you could be standing up there on Oscar night. Exciting, optimistic times to have survived from the AIDS crisis.
Absolutely true.
What do you carry with that in terms of responsibility as an
artist?
Oh,
just so much. That's a big one. Just so much loss of so many amazing people, and the opportunity to have been able to work with so many of them before we lost them, and that's extraordinary. A partner of mine, James Lyons, who was a boyfriend but also a editor of mine on many movies, and an amazing guy, who did pass away in 2006 from HIV, but I just met his nephew at the Cincinnati Film Festival, who just introduced himself to me, and it just broke me in two, because it just felt like, wow, we've all, you know, some of us are moving on and continuing on, you know, and then there's people who didn't get to do that, you know, but they carry so much weight in my life.
And they'll be under the lights if this film gets the notoriety along with you.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
So many.
It's all part of
artists from that era. I have a huddled mass of friends and names that they lost.
Definitely.
That they carry with them always.
Yes.
Well, Todd, it's so great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure.
Todd Haynes is the Oscar-nominated director of Far From Heaven, I'm Not There, Safe, and many other films. His newest film, Carol, is in theaters now. And here's something to take with you today, some good news and bad news, and you'll have to decide. Scientists have found a way to connect up living plant species to digital circuits. These new electronic roses from Sweden allow scientists to see how they are doing and to regulate them with a flick of a switch. Roses with USB ports. And the bad news is this. We're down to three white rhinos left in the world. Nola, the white at the San Diego Zoo, was put down, officials said, after a bacterial infection got out of control. The white rhino is believed to be the animal most in danger of extinction on planet Earth. Did I say good news and bad news? Digital roses and extinction for white rhinos. Actually, that's a tough one. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this Thanksgiving week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.